loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by my co-host Walter Smolarek, standing in for Brian Becker. First, in demonstrations today, the Israeli army and police killed at least 11 Palestinian protesters, injured more than 100, and thousands more were arrested. In response to the Israeli government's announcement that it would expropriate thousands of acres of Palestinian land to build the settlement, a general strike and protests were organized in Arab towns all over the country in 1976, and ever since then, March 30th has been commemorated as Land Day. Then, on our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming elections, a special election is coming soon in solidly Republican Arizona. But Republicans are panicking there and are spending millions of dollars in what should be a safe seat to try to head off what could be a disaster for them. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court will take up the issue of gerrymandering. But will their decision have any impact on this year's races? But before we get to the Israeli killing of Palestinians today and on Land Day 42 years ago, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Crystal Mason lives in Texas. She was recently released after a short prison sentence for inflating tax deductions for her accounting clients. When she got home, her mother urged her to register to vote. Crystal did, and she voted in the 2016 election. She had no idea that it was illegal for felons to vote in Texas. And yesterday, she was sentenced to 5 years in a state prison for what the state calls illegal voting. Next, schools across 8 districts in Kentucky closed today after teachers went on strike or called in sick over the legislature's decision to change their pensions. Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin tweeted that the teachers should be grateful that they have a funded pension. Meanwhile, teachers in Oklahoma and Arizona, inspired by the recent successful teacher strike in West Virginia, are also talking about striking. Then, Terry James Albury, the only African-American FBI agent in Minneapolis, was arrested this week and charged under the Espionage Act for providing documents to The Intercept that showed how the FBI infiltrates ethnic organizations and black empowerment groups. Albury's attorneys have already said that their client would plead guilty. And then the official results of the Egyptian election are in, and to no one's surprise, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has been re-elected with over 90% of the vote. But as the economy falters and the demands of the 2011 revolution go unmet, how secure is his regime really? And finally, we take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. And in other headlines, retail giant Walmart is in talks to buy health insurer Humana, a move similar to its competitor CVS's merger with Aetna late last year. Walmart already offers some healthcare options, but this would constitute a major expansion. Walmart is also locked in competition with Amazon, which is also involved in health insurance. Noor Salman, the widow of Pulse nightclub shooter Omar Mateen, has been acquitted of providing information to a terrorist organization and providing support in the June 2016 mass shooting in Orlando. Mateen killed 49 people and injured more than 50 in one of the worst mass shootings in American history. Yesterday, French President Emmanuel Macron hosted a delegation of the Syrian Democratic Forces, a fighting force led by the Kurdish YPG militia, and offered to mediate between the Kurds and the Turkish government. But today, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rejected Macron's offer and labeled the YPG terrorists, saying, quote, "Who are you to mediate between Turkey and a terror group?" Unquote. Meanwhile, despite Pentagon assertions to the contrary, President Trump mentioned in a speech that he is planning to pull the U.S. out of Syria. The State Department published a proposal today that would require the past 5 years of social media profile data to be included in all visa applications when people seek entry into the United States. Critics are outraged at such a broad expansion of data collection by the government. The proposal notes that approximately 14.7 million people would be affected. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the Israeli killing of Palestinians today who were demonstrating on Land Day. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
And now we turn to Palestine. We're joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. Welcome.
Good to be with you guys.
So Dan, 10 people killed today at least in Land Day demonstrations, over 1,000 injured, many, many more arrested. What's going on in Palestine and Gaza today?
Well, right now, tens of thousands of of Palestinians, mostly refugees in the Gaza Strip, are taking part in a what they're calling the March of Return. And what they mean by that is return to the lands they were expelled from in 1948 and 1967 in what is now known as Israel. And so Israel has typically used massive military force to suppress the protest. The Israeli military chief, Gadi Eisenkot, authorized 100 snipers to open fire on these unarmed protesters. You also have soldiers in training taking part in this attack. So, you know, it's in the same vein as Israel using Gaza as a laboratory. You know, this is what's happening. And as you said, 10 Palestinians have been killed, hundreds injured. And, you know, I think we have to understand why these people are, why they're marching to return. It's not, and why Israel is responding with such heavy-handed violence. It's not because these refugees necessarily pose any kind of physical threat, but simply because they do not fit the definition of what the state wants for Israeli citizens, meaning they are not Jewish. And so for that, they're gunned down mercilessly. They're also being heavily suppressed with tear gas that is delivered from the top of Israeli military jeeps, and not only on the jeeps, but from drones as well. And just in the past month, that's kind of a new development, that the Israeli army is tear gassing unarmed civilians via drone. And so it's just basically a bloodbath, and should be rightly understood as a massacre.
So every year there are demonstrations on Land Day in Palestine and elsewhere around the world by Palestinians and their supporters. But this demonstration, of course, is exceptional in terms of its intensity. What's different about this year than previous years?
Well, I mean, this year it's a major organized rally, and I think it's kind of in response to increased Israeli aggression, the ongoing siege, and kind of life being completely unbearable and there being no future for Palestinians. Of course, it comes on Land Day, which commemorates in what happened in 1976 when Israeli police shot and killed 6 Palestinian citizens of Israel who were protesting the Israeli government's theft of Palestinian land in the Galilee in what is now considered northern Israel. So even, you know, Palestinian citizens of Israel are subject to this kind of wanton violence. But, you know, in Gaza, I haven't been back to Gaza in about a year, but I was able to spend about 7 months there over a 2-year period. And every time I would go back, there was this kind of increasing sense of desperation where you could see it in people's body language, where there's no future. There's, you know, the best job that a young person can kind of hope for is like a taxi driver, and that's just to make ends meet. And so you have this young, educated population, where more than 50% of the population is under 18, and with absolutely no future. And so that is a perfect recipe for deep frustration. And so you have young people going to the border to voice, you know, they're discontent with, you know, being locked in a tiny bombed out cage. And the only way that they can deliver a message to the outside world is essentially to sacrifice at least their ability to walk. You know, there have been hundreds shot in the legs. That's Israel's shoot to cripple policy that was pioneered by the great peace man, Yitzhak Rabin. Hundreds of young people are sacrificing their ability to walk, and some with their lives, simply to deliver a message to the outside world that they demand a better future and the rights that any person should have. Unfortunately, Western media is completely turning a blind eye to this and is essentially giving Israel a green light to just mow these young people down and take their lives.
Dan, do you see any kind of international pressure coming to bear on the Israelis, whether it's from the United States or France or even the Russians. Is there anybody out there that is willing to say enough is enough? We have 11 more Palestinians dead, at least 11 more so far today. Thousands are being rounded up and arrested. Is there anybody supporting them?
Sadly, not. I mean, Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, are more isolated than ever. You know, Hamas maintains some connections to Qatar and to Iran, but those, you know, even Qatar is now trying to cozy up to the U.S. through Israel, through, you know, what it sees is through the Israel lobbies is the way to cozy up to the U.S. And so that's not, you know, exactly a reliable partner for or a reliable source of support for Palestinians. And of course, from the West, from, you know, the U.S. and the EU, it's a total green light to continue to colonize Palestinian land, to shoot young people, you know, people of all ages, men, women, children, to shoot them down and kill them. And, you know, it's like if you watch the State Department press briefings with Heather Nauert, the former Fox and Friends host, who she's the outgoing State Department spokesperson. But if you watch her every day, I go to these briefings from time to time and I watch them. Saeed Erekat, the Al-Quds journalist, he asks about Israeli policy every time. And and Heather Nauert's response every time is, oh, well, I'm going to have to refer you to the Israeli government on that. And so there's never, you know, well, countries that are designated enemies of the U.S., whether, you know, Venezuela or any typically like socialist country, are decried for, you know, alleged human rights violations. Israel, the State Department refers clear violations of human rights from Israel to the Israeli government. And so it's just complete, total impunity for the, you know, world's only apartheid state.
In 2012, the United Nations put out a report that estimated that Gaza would become, in their words, unlivable by 2020. And last year, they put out another report, and they said that actually that was too optimistic, that conditions were deteriorating, quote, further and faster than their 2012 prediction. I'm looking at an article from Palestine News Network now, and it reads, this is from last month. Municipalities across the Gaza Strip announced on Wednesday that raw sewage waste will be pumped directly into the sea due to fuel shortages. That means fuel shortages at treatment plants as the humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to worsen. I mean, is there going to be a breaking point here? I mean, is this sort of the explosion, the demonstrations today on Land Day and the subsequent Israeli, you know, extreme, violent, deadly repression? Is this sort of the breaking point that people have been talking about for some time?
Well, I think the Israeli strategy with Gaza is to basically keep it hovering right above the breaking point, where essentially life is unbearable, but there's not like a mass explosion of violence. And every few months, we see, you know, a report saying Gaza is on the breaking point of a major explosion. And then the UN says, you know, we need aid urgently for Gaza. And so maybe there's a little bit more, you know, just to kind of keep it hovering right above that point. But then there's, you know, nothing fundamentally changes, and it's kind of like a broken record. This happens again and again. And so it's true that Gaza will be unlivable, but actually Gaza is unlivable. I mean, if you know, young people, as I was saying, have no future. There's rolling blackouts where electricity, you get, you know, maybe 2 to 4 hours per day. You know, people wake up in the middle of their night to charge their cell phone. And this is, you know, with Israeli S-16s and drones overhead all the time, keeping people in a constant state of terror. You have very little clean drinking water, as I said. And as you were mentioning, you have raw sewage flowing into the sea because Israel bombed the water, the wastewater treatment plants repeatedly. And those were never repaired. And so Palestinians are simply, essentially living in their own sewage because Israel will not allow them first to repair these wastewater treatment plants, and then will not allow fuel to run them. So if you go to the beach in Gaza, I mean, these are, you know, the most stunning Mediterranean beaches, but you can't go in the water because it's filled with sewage. There was even a boy who, I mean, some people swim in it anyway. You know, you can try to find patches where you can swim, as, you know, I've done that. And one boy died as a result of getting sick from the sewage in the water. And finally, Israel started to ring the bell on this a few months ago, simply because the sewage was starting to flow onto Israeli beaches a bit to the north. And so, you know, in Ashdod, Ashkelon, which are, you know, Israeli towns, people go out and swim, and now they're complaining that Palestinian sewage is flowing up from Gaza, but they don't understand that it's simply because their military bombed their sewage plants.
You know, I remember in the 1990s, the government of Saudi Arabia offered to pay for a sewage treatment plant for Gaza, or a series of sewage treatment plants for Gaza, and the Israeli government refused. They just wouldn't allow the Gaza Palestinians to even have sewage and water treatment facilities.
Well, yes. I mean, that's all part of the strategy of making Gaza into a living hell for the 2 million people there. I think ultimately Israel's goal is to make Gaza so unlivable that Palestinians leave, because what horrifies Israelis is the idea that Palestinians might want to return to the lands from which they're ethnically cleansed for not being Jewish, because the whole basis of the Israeli state is that it is a Jews-only state, or at the very least, a Jewish-majority state. And therefore, indigenous Palestinians pose a so-called demographic threat to its makeup as a Jewish state. And so the whole idea has been to seal off Gaza from Israel, to say that basically the 2 million Palestinians there don't exist. But I think it goes beyond that to ultimately forcing them to leave the area completely. There's really no other way to explain the calculated and deliberate cruelty of denying people basic things like electricity, wastewater treatment. Israel has so destroyed the aquifer, and the so-called international community is now banding together to build, and I don't know that it will ever be built, but they've pledged to build a $500 million desalination plant for Gaza. And they're marketing this as some great solution to the situation in Gaza. But of course, it actually makes things worse, because when all the natural water resources have been destroyed, and you make people dependent on a very expensive, complicated, and fuel-intensive desalination plant, it actually gives Israel even more control, because now, you know, you need fuel to run that plant, you need spare parts, you need international experts to be able to come in. So really, even the aid that is being given to Gaza ends up making the situation worse. And the only reason I can see is ultimately to try to force the people out.
Ali, Gaza is governed by a different authority than the West Bank. You know, the West Bank, I mean, large parts are, of course, still under direct Israeli military rule, but there's the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and then a Hamas-run administration in Gaza. Tell us about the division and how the siege began.
The siege in its current form dates back to 2007, but really to 2006, when Palestinians held legislative elections at the insistence, by the way, of the Bush administration at the time, and Hamas handily won them. And instead of doing the democratic thing and recognizing that result and handing the reins of the Palestinian Authority over to Hamas, which had run, by the way, on a very moderate platform of, you know, reform and fighting corruption and good governance, and had been willing, by the way, even though it won, to form a sort of a power-sharing authority with the losers, with Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah faction, the so-called international community decided on a policy of complete rejectionism and denying Hamas's victory and placing the Palestinian Authority as a whole under siege, cutting off funding and so on. in order to force Hamas out. And this culminated in 2007 in a Bush administration-backed effort at a coup, a Contra-style operation where they had this Gaza strongman, Mohammed Dahlan, who the Bush administration had designated as their guy, and these Fatah-loyal militias who were supposed to overthrow Hamas. What happened in June 2007 was that Hamas essentially preempted that coup attempt, threw them out of Gaza, and maintained its control. And after that, Israel, the so-called international community, and the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah got together and placed Gaza under this much tighter siege, even counting the calories of how much food was allowed in per person, the number of calories per person, in order to make the population suffer so much that they would eventually turn against Hamas and demand that Mahmoud Abbas ride back into Gaza on Israeli tanks. That never happened, and so Israel tried through military means to do what starvation siege couldn't do. And so we've seen in 2008, 2012, and 2014 massive Israeli military assaults on bogus pretexts that Israel was, trying to stop rocket fire, which was always provoked by Israel by attacking Gaza. But these military assaults were intended to force Hamas out of power and return the Palestinian Authority there, but all of them failed. And now, the situation is that they keep having these so-called reconciliation agreements, but they never work because the fundamental contradiction remains that Hamas is willing to resist Israel, even if it's only in defensive wars, whereas the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah remains closely allied to Israel. And so, any notion of reconciliation just falls flat.
Dan Cohen, you made a film along with Max Blumenthal about one of those assaults that Ali Abu Nima is talking about the 2014 Israeli bombing campaign in Gaza. Tell us a little bit more about that, and how do these military assaults contribute along with the siege to create the conditions that led to the massive demonstrations that we saw today in Gaza and the bloody Israeli repression?
Well, Max and I were able to enter Gaza in the final 2.5 weeks of the 2014 Israeli assault that lasted for 51 days. We entered during a 5-day ceasefire with the intention of documenting people's stories as they returned to their homes that had been reduced to rubble and dug, their loved ones' bodies out of the rubble of their homes. And we quickly realized that we had to make a documentary out of the footage that we were getting. And so I continued to go back for about the next 2 years. Like I said, I spent 7 months in Gaza. And I kind of documented the everyday crises of people living under siege where, things that you and I take for granted in terms of electricity, water, these kinds of things are simply unavailable. So whether it's flooded streets where Palestinians are not allowed to have fuel to remove water from their streets. So they have to take boats and people are stuck in their homes and, dealing with these everyday difficulties children freezing to death because they don't, their homes were not rebuilt because Israel essentially wouldn't allow it. And so, this film kind of documents what Western media has totally ignored, that, even after the so-called ceasefire, which, ended the 51-day war, it was a one-way ceasefire. And Israel continues, as we see today, to open fire on Palestinian civilians. And the people, I've been to these kinds of protests, and it's young people who, we have to understand what they've been through, that not only do they have no future in Gaza because they're totally isolated, also these people have been through so much misery and trauma. I mean, these are the people like east of Shujaiya, where a lot of this is happening, at the Nahalaz border crossing. These are people who had their families massacred. And so I think, you know, one of the most kind of not perplexing, but challenging ideas for me that really took a lot of being on the ground and just talking to people about why do you go, you know, why would these young men, why would these young people go to the border when they know they're going to get shot? And it's simply because they understand that they have no future and they have to deliver a message and to the outside world that they refuse to die under siege quietly. That if they're going to live in these horrible conditions, they're at least going to say something about it. And, you know, these are people whose loved ones were killed and there was never any justice for it. And so this is what they've been reduced to. And so we really try to document that in the movie and, you know, hopefully, you know, we're able to deliver their message to Western audiences.
Ali, we have just a little bit under a minute left. In our final period here, can you tell us about the BDS movement and how people can get involved in that?
Well, learn more about it by going to bdsmovement.net or at the Electronic Intifada, my publication. I just came back from South Africa. Everyone in South Africa told me international solidarity helped to free us. International sporting boycotts, cultural, academic, consumer boycotts against apartheid South Africa helped liberate us. That's what Palestinians are calling for on Israel. Nonviolent international global solidarity to level the playing field, to put pressure on Israel, which is overwhelmingly more powerful than the Palestinians, to force Israel to finally end its occupation, its regime of settler colonialism and apartheid, and respect the rights of Palestinians. That's the logic of BDS. It's not hate. It's not anti-Semitism. It's not all the lies that Israel and its lobby groups tell. It's about solidarity with Palestinians seeking their fundamental rights, who are now being gunned down simply for demonstrating for those rights peacefully. Here's the thing that is so disturbing. You have all these, you know, liberals who constantly lecture the Palestinians. I've been hearing it for the past 20 years. Oh, if only the Palestinians would be like Gandhi and carry out mass peaceful marches, the whole world will stand with them. Well, look what's happening today in Gaza. Where are all these people who claim they would stand with the Palestinians? Let's see them do it now. And one way they can do it is by backing the Palestinian call for boycott of the Israeli apartheid regime.
We're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Chicago by Ali Abu Nima. He's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada and author of the book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And we were joined from Washington, D.C. by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. He and Max Blumenthal made a film called Killing Gaza. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We continue our regular Friday segment covering the upcoming midterm elections. A special election is coming soon in a solidly Republican district in Florida, but Republicans are panicking and spending millions of dollars in what should be a safe seat. Republicans are also in trouble in the Philadelphia suburbs, where incumbent Ryan Costello has announced that he will not seek re-election. And meanwhile, the Supreme Court will take up the issue of gerrymandering. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Luqman and Abdus Luqman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Luqman Nation. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So maybe we should start with Ryan Costello in Philadelphia. Is it a surprise? What do you think?
It's not a surprise to see how spectacularly Donald Trump is destroying the Republican Party, because really that's what this is. There is now no logical, reasonable defense of Trump policies that even Republicans can come up with. And they realize this. And even in these congressional races where the seats were supposed to be safe, now that they don't even want to fight. They don't even want to fight for their seats because they realize they have nothing to fight for.
And Costello has a lot to lose, because he's 41 years old. So he has an entire, you know, two-decade career still ahead of him.
Right.
And in the House of Representatives, you have to serve three terms to qualify for the pension, and he's only served two.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's jumping ship.
That's really jumping ship. He has made a conclusion that he just simply cannot win this race. Not because his constituents don't like him.
Mm-hmm.
By all accounts, this was a toss-up. Maybe they do like him.
Right, right.
But he just cannot carry Donald Trump's policies on his back.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier, Abdus, about how for a lot of Republicans, it's not so much that they can't support Trump. Because remember when the Democrats abandoned President Obama during their midterms, they distanced themselves from him. So that's not unusual.
No.
Midterm candidates not.
Especially in a first term.
Exactly. What's unusual here is that Donald Trump is a personally petty kind of president. So any kind of abdication or lack of support for him that these Republicans in these midterm races show, they know he'll come after them personally.
Yeah, he really will. And he has in the past as well.
Well, I also think that when we talk about the Pennsylvania thing with Ryan Costello, a lot of it especially is with the courts about the redistricting and having new districts. Ryan called it racist, you know, which I don't understand why, but he called it racist. But I think a lot of it has to do with the game that they rigged in Pennsylvania is being unrigged, and they realize that they just can't win on policy alone. Now, this also goes back to an exodus of Republican candidates who are not seeking reelection. I think the last I read was like 36.
Yeah, which is more than it's been in the last century.
Oh, yeah. I think one article I read was like, this is like the highest since 1930, you know. So, again, I think that we can blame a lot of this on Trump. If we remember that Trump has really damaged, let's forget about the brand of the Republican Party. He personally went against a lot of policies. We got the trade war. We got a lot of other things that's happening that the GOP just wasn't standing behind. And I think that has a lot to do with it, too.
Oh, just wait until he gets moving on this infrastructure bill. There's not a Republican on Capitol Hill that wants to vote for an infrastructure bill.
Oh, are you kidding? Fix our infrastructure? No.
Right, right. Yeah, when you can use that money to buy more weapons.
Exactly.
Or build a wall.
That's right.
Or build a wall. That's right.
So with Republicans like Ryan Costello not running for re-election, I mean, this is going to accelerate the rightward march of the Republican Party even further to right-wing extremism. I mean, the 2010 Tea Party, you know, that was seen as like the insurgency back then, but it's like the mainstream now, right?
Yeah, I agree. You know, the thing about this exodus, or I can't even say this exodus, this all of these Republicans deciding not to seek re-election, it's very good for the Democrats. The thing of it is that I feel that, and I was talking, Jackie and I was talking about this today, I think another incentive for, and I know I'm reaching here a little bit, but I think another incentive for a lot of these Republicans not returning is the tax bill. I think that the tax legislation that Trump signed basically was like their golden parachute. They don't have to come back. You know?
I think, you know, for people who look at who benefited from that legislation, from the tax bill, it wasn't us. It wasn't, you know, working class folks. And we see Ryan Costello saying that he's going to take a position as a lobbyist or something. Well, yeah, I think there's a little bit of credence that you can pay to that and say, yeah, I can see that being like their retirement plan almost. So maybe he doesn't care that he loses his pension because the money he's going to make in the next couple of years as a lobbyist.
Exactly.
There may be something to that. There was an article this week in Politico saying that the Republicans are flailing around on the Hill right now looking for an issue, something that they can force through the legislative process. And the only thing they've come up with is another tax cut.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So maybe that's it, you know?
Yeah.
It was the largest tax. The last one was the largest tax cut in, you know, generations. And maybe they do another one.
And what's interesting, what's even more interesting in this whole Republican implosion, the implosion of the Republican Party, because as we know it, because it's not like the Republican Party is going away. It's just metastasizing into something even more horrible than it used to be. We thought the Tea Party was bad, but this is genuinely concerning. And we can look at some of the Democratic Party's strategies in the elections, in the primaries, to highlight the worst of the Republican candidates leading the field. So they bear some responsibility in this. But at the same time, I'm looking at these Republicans who always campaign on their values that are so much better that they claim than the rest of the candidates, that they've got better values than the Democrats. They're more Democratic. They care about democracy more than anybody else does. But they try to rig their own districts to ensure that they continue to win, which is denying people democracy. They especially in the Pennsylvania 6th, they created two primarily POC black districts in Philadelphia that were largely Democratic, so that they wouldn't have to worry about those people voting for them. So they gerrymandered the 6th all the way around those two districts. And now they turn it around and say, oh, well, the Supreme Court reversing that is racist because they eliminated these POC majority districts, but they created them so that they didn't have to worry about those people voting for them. But these are people who say they run on these stellar moral policies, but they don't have the moral fortitude to fight for what they've always claimed they believed in. So people are seeing this in these Republican candidates now. And a lot of people, I think, who have been solidly Republican are seeing the ship sinking, and they're just kind of standing back going, oh, yeah. Well.
And from a practical standpoint, that's why these midterm elections are so important, because we have a census coming up, and it's the census that determines reapportionment.
Yeah. Right.
Who gets the money?
And then who controls the reapportionment? In most states, a couple of notable exceptions being California and New York, but in most states, it's the state legislatures.
Right.
And most of those state legislatures have become Republican over the last decade.
Yes.
So that's why this election is so important for so many different reasons. It's not just about sending a message to Donald Trump. It's about transforming the way Congress is going to look for the next 10 years.
Exactly. And the marching orders for the Democrats need to be, you need to govern for the people. You cannot, the Democrats cannot look at these seats that are opening up in the House and possibly even the Senate as just a win for the party. Either the people win, or they're really just another wing of the same evil bird, as W.E.B. Du Bois has said so famously.
And you know, what they did with the Dreamers, I think, really indicates that they're not heading in that direction now. I mean, they finally had a chance to fight, right? They could have stood up for immigrants. They could have, which is like enormously popular. I mean, even among people who, you know, are not immigrants, like it's I don't know, 70% of people like support DACA, the support relief for Dreamers. Right. But I mean, Abdus, why don't you think they stood up on that issue?
Well, I think one of the reasons why they didn't stand up on the issue is because they're pandering to, I mean, I hate to say it, but a lot of the people in their districts, even Democrats in their districts, don't really, really kind of side with Trump a little bit. Maybe not as extreme as some of the so-called Tea Partyists, Republicans that, or the Trumpsters. But there is, you know, as much as you just said, that there is a large percentage of people that support it, I don't really think it's that large. I think that the reason why these Democrats that haven't stood up, because there is a certain percentage and a large percentage of people in their districts who really voice concerns like, hey, take care of us first. And, you know, so I really believe that it's not as high as you may think. You know, I kind of disagree with that. I just think that that in their districts, they're pandering to their own constituency who really don't support it as much as we think they do.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of valid, because we've seen the rightward shift of the Democratic Party.
Boy, have we.
Over the
past
few
decades.
Exactly. For how many decades has that been? Mm-hmm. How old am I? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, we're talking about, you know, Bill Clinton winning 26 years ago.
Right. Almost three decades.
Right. So I think it is not unreasonable to suggest that the Democrats are hearing from some of their own constituents in supposedly solidly Democratic districts that, you know, yeah, we don't like Trump, but maybe some of his ideas aren't so bad.
That's the danger. That's the danger for the Democrats, because if the Democrats allow Trump to co-opt, for example, the labor movement, I mean, there's a quarter of the Democratic base right there. And then what do? Then you see Donald Trump winning states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan again.
Mm-hmm. Which has always been the danger of the Democratic Party not standing for its platform that and, it was know, supposed the, to be about.
The funny the thing about that, too, is they used to see that as a negative.
Yes.
They used to call that the McGovernization of the party.
Yes.
And
yes.
they said that they yep. would never allow another candidate like George McGovern to push the party that far to the left where the Democrats lost 49 states.
Right.
In fact, what they did is they pushed away their own base and moved the Democratic Party so far to the right that Democrats, you know, so many of them would rather just sit home than go to the polls on Election Day.
Yeah, because it's not a real opposition out there.
Exactly.
You know, it's just Republican light. But I want to get back to, Jackie, what you were saying. I think what the whole thing is that we have to understand is that Americans are hurting. That's number one. Whether you're on the right or whether you're on the left, whether you call yourself a Democrat or you call yourself a Republican, this government has not given any incentive to the people to support things like DACA or to support. I mean, people are just so apathetic when it comes to these other issues because Americans are hurting. One of the things that I've seen in the paper today was that some of the Republicans who aren't returning, one of the things that they claim was an excuse for them not seeking reelection is the fact that nothing can get done in Washington. And I think that the American people, we see that, and it's just like, well, why should I support this or support that when I'm hurting?
Right.
And I think that that's the general overall feeling in this country.
And I think that's very true, because what voters see in us living 7 miles from the Capitol,
right.
we see it all the time. We see what they can get done, and the things they can get done almost never benefit the people.
Yeah.
And if we see this, then everybody else in this country sees this. We're not, you know, any more aware of, you know, what's going on in politics than your average person who has an internet connection. Everybody sees the truth now.
It's funny that you say that. I went to college here in Washington. I've been here since 1982. And I remember back in the 80s and even into the 90s, when you would see at night the light on at the top of the dome of the Capitol, you
right.
knew that Congress was still in session.
Right.
And I remember saying to myself, oh, they're debating the education bill or they're debating the highway bill.
They're doing some work.
They're doing something.
yeah, yeah.
And now you say, oh, they're fighting again.
Right.
Or they're filibustering again.
Right. Right.
Or they can't pass a continuing resolution.
Right, right. Wow. Or they're passing some corporate-friendly legislation
yeah.
that gives Amazon more tax breaks or, you know, I don't want to pick on Amazon.
Or give the Pentagon
president
more
is.
Money.
right,
right.
You know, or give some people more money that really don't need any more money. But we know now that if that light is on at the top of the dome in the middle of the night, we know now that these people are not fighting for us.
No.
None of them.
No,
almost
they're saving themselves.
Them.
That's it.
And you know, if we look at like the situation in society in the 1980s, 1990s, where there wasn't, you know, the same type of like, you know, the thing in the media is governing by crisis, right? So, okay, the government's going to shut down by this date. That's when we have to pass the budget, or, you know, the debt ceiling is going to run out at this point. You know, like the whole political and economic system in the United States was much stronger. It was in better shape back then, right? So in the 1980s and the 1990s, there was, you know, corporations were making lots and lots of money. It wasn't a great time for ordinary people, not necessarily, but, you know, sure. for the people at the top, it was like pretty good time, 80s and 90s. And the same was true about the international situation that the United States found itself in. You know, it was winning the Cold War. It was, you know, developing this, you know, it was the sole superpower in the world. But, you know, after the 2008 economic crisis, after the U.S. was defeated in Iraq, you know, it's much harder to agree on things when things aren't going your way. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And that's very true. But I also think I just, you know, mentioned the internet, the advent of access to information because of the internet now, it is so much harder to fool the population. It is so much harder. And it's not that that's not being done. And I'm not even talking about Russia, because I don't care what anybody says. They weren't even a factor in this election. We have access to information about policies that we thought were a good idea 20 years ago. Now we're finding out, wait a minute, this didn't benefit us at all, because if they did, why are we in the situation we are in now? So more people are more informed today about policies and who is really benefiting from some of these policies that are being passed now and have been passed in the future. And more people are waking up to the realization that, wait, we really haven't benefited from much of this. And what do we do? And I think that this whole Republican exodus, all of these midterm candidates not seeking reelection, is their response to the American question of what do we do? They don't have one.
No.
They have no response.
They don't
know what to do. Yeah. So they literally just jump ship.
And every rat knows when to leave a sinking ship anyway. So
let's talk about this special election in Arizona. This is a very odd kind of special election for a few different reasons. Number one, it's hardly getting any press play at all. You know, when you were here the last time and the time before, we talked at length about Pennsylvania's 18th district mm-hmm. and the Connor Lamb election.
Right.
This Arizona race is not getting that kind of coverage. And I'm wondering why. So it pits a Republican state senator named Debbie Lesko against a Democrat named Hilal Tipperneni. She's a physician who has raised $300,000 on her own in what has always, always been a Republican district. Not only is it a Republican district, but it includes Sun City, Arizona, which was the center of the base of support for Joe Arpaio when he was running time and time again for sheriff of Maricopa County. Miracle of miracles, all of a sudden, this is a competitive race. The incumbent congressman had to resign in shame for sexually harassing two staff members and asking one to be a surrogate mother for his child. So he left.
Those family values again.
It's family values. And so all of a sudden it's a race. There's a Republican pollster by the name of Mike Noble saying this is a red seat. So they shouldn't normally even have to spend anything on this race. But Republicans are on defense. Politico calls it a dumpster fire, right? The race is an election dumpster fire. The RNC and the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee have already spent $500,000, this is just outside money, on advertising, in addition to the $500,000 that the candidate has spent, and the polls show a neck-and-neck race. Mm. The Republican is slightly ahead because this is a district that Donald Trump won by 21 percentage points. Does that sound familiar?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But they're really on the defensive. And Politico concludes, as does the newspaper The Hill, that the Republican will probably win, but that's not necessarily a good thing for the Republican Party, because if the win is thin, if it's narrow, that portends a potential disaster for other Republicans, whether they're defending open seats or are incumbents. And also, it forced the party to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars that they otherwise could have and would have spent in closer races elsewhere around the country.
Right. And this is bad, too, because this reminds me of the Connor Lamb race that we just seen. This district that this is happening in is heavily religious, retired people. I mean, this is tailor-made. Mm-hmm. This is their base. And if they cannot effectively win big with them, just like they did up in Pennsylvania. Yes, John, you're right. There's some serious issues there. And those arrows point to Trump. I'm sorry, but it points right to him.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. They point to Trump.
Yep.
I have not seen in any of the midterm races where Republicans are struggling, any of the Republican candidates coming out and openly campaigning on the benefits of Trump's policy.
No, they tried that in Pennsylvania.
And it
in
was
a heavily
disaster.
Republican district. And it was a disaster. Now, with that said, the Washington Post had a piece this week, actually more than one. They've written four articles in the last 3 weeks saying Democrats, don't get your hopes up.
Right.
Yeah.
Because in a normal watershed election, you can tell it's going to be a watershed if the generic polls show one party beating the other party by 6 percentage points, okay? Mm-hmm. Well, the current polls show a generic Democrat beating a generic Republican in Congress by between 9 and 14 percentage points. They're saying that may not be enough for the Democrats to win back the House because the Republicans have been so successful at gerrymandering over the last 20 years that the Democrats are going to have to win maybe 12 percentage point victory nationwide to elect enough Democrats to take over the House. Unless, of course, the Supreme Court steps in. And we know now, because day before yesterday, the Supreme Court said they would, that they are going to hear these questions. So they're looking at Maryland, where actually it was the Democrats that did the gerrymandering.
Right. That's right.
And they're looking at Wisconsin. Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, has a very weak case, and Governor Walker has admitted that the case is weak. The Supreme Court's also looking at North Carolina, which successfully gerrymandered three Democrats right out of their seats.
Wow. Mm.
And so if you combine Pennsylvania, which is already done, the map is written, and North Carolina and Wisconsin, and then you take into consideration the 5 to 9 seats that the Democrats expect to pick up in California, well, then maybe this is going to be a watershed election.
I think the problem I have, always the problem I have with this whole Democratic wave, the blue wave that they're calling it, is that it is built on nothing but electoral wins.
It's built on nothing but hatred of Trump.
That's a better way to put it. Yes.
You have to have a program. You have to have a policy. You have to stand for something.
It's not built on policy. It's not.
Asked you right now, what are Nancy Pelosi's top policy concerns? Would you have any idea?
I can tell you.
Blank. I'm not even sure she could tell us. And that's the problem.
But there's a reason why that they're not coming out on standing on anything. And I believe that they calculated that if we come out too soon with a platform, we're going to lose the Trumpsters. And that's what I believe.
They're
sitting back saying, it's like playing cards. We're not going to reveal our hand because we don't want to turn off the people we're trying to attract so early.
Right.
You know,
right.
So.
But then the problem is if you're appealing only to those people that you're trying to draw only because of the hatred of this one, you know, this one guy, and that's the only platform you have, then what's in it for the rest of us?
Yeah, right.
And that's the whole, this whole gerrymandering thing is also becoming a more revealed issue. More people are understanding the importance of gerrymandering because I think, like most politics, most people don't really understand the ins and outs and the nuances of politics and how policy is made. We don't understand, and we haven't understood for a long time, that bills really aren't made, you know, aren't really passed because of the little schoolhouse rock formula.
Right. They're written by lobbyists.
Literally all written by lobbyists.
Right. So, you know, the issue of gerrymandering comes up and people don't understand it. They hear about it. But now that they're living it in places like Pennsylvania and Maryland, North Carolina and Wisconsin, they see that it robs them of their actual voice. And both parties do it. But if either party had a platform, if they had policies where they could use to appeal to people and meet people's needs, they wouldn't need to gerrymander districts. They could just run on their platforms and let the people decide. And people are waking up to this and they're angry.
And the Supreme Court's waking up to this.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
You know, one of my best friends in the world and one of my oldest friends is a judge in New York State. And he told me the other day that he opposes just on a philosophical basis, he opposes the Supreme Court getting involved in redistricting because it's so far down in the weeds and it's political rather than legal, he says, that it's better for the Supreme Court to just ignore it, except in this case. He said, this case is so egregious and it so denies political representation to so many Americans that the Supreme Court had to step in. That there are entire classes of Americans who really are not being represented politically only because of gerrymandering.
That's right.
And I think that a majority of the Supreme Court has come to the same conclusion. I mean, we talked the other day, not the other day, but the last couple of weeks about Samuel Alito, probably, arguably, the most conservative member of the Supreme Court. It was Alito who denied the Republicans in Pennsylvania a hearing to reject the governor's map.
Yeah, wow. Which was a shock.
Mm. It was a shock. If even Alito says you've gone too far,
you've really gone too far.
Right.
Yeah. And again, I can't look at any of these midterms, whether Republicans win by the skin of their teeth or, you know, whether Democrats win by the skin of their teeth. It doesn't matter who wins in a lot of these skin close midterm races or special elections. They all spell trouble for both parties. For both parties.
Yeah, that's true.
And I don't know which party is in worse trouble. I'm not sure. I just know that like you said, Abdus, Americans are hurting. And a lot of Americans are waking up to the realization that neither one of these parties are doing anything about their pain.
And one thing that you notice, because we spoke about this the other day, is the absence or silence of the so-called Republican old guard. You don't see Powell, you don't see Bush, you're right. Yeah, and they're staying out of this because they understand that they don't even know what the heck is going on.
That's right. Remember, they were all part of this Never Trump movement,
right.
And then
yes.
Trump won.
That's
mm-hmm.
right.
And so they're stuck. So what do? Do they jump in on the side of Trump
or
do they stay with this Never Trump movement?
Right,
and
right.
So they're not saying anything to anybody.
And they're not even coming and trying to even save the Republican Party. Like you don't see this intervention that's coming in saying, look, we're going to take back the party for what you don't see it. Like you said, they're just like staying out of it.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be an interesting, what, next 6 years? It's going to be a very
Seriously.
Interesting six to 8 years.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined in studio by Jacqueline and Abdus Luqman. They're the co-editors in chief of Luqman Nation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.